Well, this is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, host Sheldon Brown, and Happy New Year to everybody. And thank you very much to Declan, who handled last week's show and the week before, which of course was Christmas Eve Day. I've listened to Declan's show for last week, and sounded as though it had a pretty good balance of music and some nice little snippets help.
Are you, are you trying to get some brownie points?
Oh, well, I wouldn't mind a few brownie points. I feel as though I've lost a few not being here for the last 2 weeks. But anyway, take it from us, Mental Health Radio is brought to you and funded by Ember Wellbeing Trust. And I've just trawled through Facebook just to find a few little snippets for today's show. And it says, okay, a show of hands, who else out there didn't do any washing this first weekend back from holidays and now has to go to work naked? Well, fortunately, Declan and I aren't naked. Ooh. And I don't think our guest certainly is not, because she's been walking around a little bit lost on the Unitech site trying to find car parks and finding Planet FM as well. But anyway, our guest is an academic researcher surveying the services of psychologists to find out what's good and what's perhaps not so good about the support we get from psychologists. And what's really important is that university researcher Alice Stevenson is seeking the voice of service users of psychologists as part of her doctorate in clinical psychology. That means that the people that use psychological services, they are the people that Alice really wants to hear from. Alice is also an ambassador for Ruck Our Roroa, the Changing Minds campaign for like minds like mine, and we'll be asking Alice about that, and has her own experience of mental health. So here's Alice to talk about her research into psychologists and their services, and she says she's a little freaked out about being on the radio, but I think she's actually quite an experienced person with the media. So welcome, Alice, to Take It From Us. Why do you have an interest in mental health and the services of psychologists?
There's many reasons I have an interest in mental health. I think my own experiences growing up really shaped the way I viewed the world and viewed people's behaviour, I guess, and the causes and what it might lead to. I had some early experiences of mental distress, and then I've experienced other episodes throughout my life, and I think that's really shaped, I guess, my passion and drive to serve disempowered people.
So it's no accident that you're working in mental health with that sort of background?
Well, I think it wasn't really an idea I came across until later in my life. I joined the workforce and did some jobs and moved around a little bit. And then I got really interested in psychiatric rehabilitation. So I started studying as an adult student. And from there, I kind of fell into psychology. So, and that was just in line, I guess, with my own goals and my own, the way that I saw the world and what I valued. So, yeah, right. I was quite lucky, really.
Well, you look like a very young adult student. So you're sort of telling us that you're a little bit older than you look. I guess a lot of people say that to you, do they?
Yes, quite often.
That you're a lot younger than you look. Sorry, I better get this right. You're a lot younger than the age that you're suggesting you are. Okay, I think we've got that sorted. Have we got that sorted, Declan?
Don't know.
Oh, you're not much of a supporter today. Anyway, Alice So a lot of your interest in this is based on these personal experiences. And where did this interest in psychiatric rehabilitation suddenly come from?
I started studying political science and was really interested in social change. And then I picked up a psychiatric rehabilitation paper, and back then it was they'd send out tapes of people experiencing episodes of distress, and something about that kind of hit my heart and kind of reminded me, I guess, of my own experiences and also of experiences that people around me had shared. So friends, family, random people. So I guess my interest kind of grew from that. Yeah, quite early on.
When you use the term psychiatric rehabilitation, it sort of suggests to me that that's people that are in acute psychiatric units working to be rehabilitated back into the community. Is that what it means or not?
Well, I think it's a poorly worded term that was used to describe the paper that I took then.
Right.
I don't know what it's called now. If I had the choice, I'd probably call it distress or something like that. But things have been changing in the psychology field quite quickly, and there were some terms that were used as a biomedical type overflow. Yeah, so I think that terminology might come from that.
Right. But what you're actually studying now is a doctorate in clinical... Sorry, you remind me.
Yeah, doctorate in clinical psychology.
In clinical psychology. So you're on a path to being a psychologist yourself.
Yes. So I've just received registration as an intern psychologist in the clinical scope. Yeah.
Right. And in a very short period of time, you're going to be an intern in Northland.
Yes, that's right.
Right. What, at the Whangarei Hospital?
At the community service there for maternal mental health.
Maternal mental health, right. Oh, okay, so is that a special interest of yours?
Yes, it is. I've always been interested in serving adult populations. I've worked with people from the age of 7 to 97 in different services. But yes, I am really interested in adult communities in particular.
So maternal mental health means people end up with postnatal depression.
Yeah, it can be that. It can be some distressing times brought on by pregnancy or childbirth. It could be a range of different types of distress experienced for different reasons.
Right.
And I think pregnancy and becoming a mother has a lot of big changes associated with it. So it's really important that people can be supported in that space.
And I suppose it's particularly significant if they're solo mothers who are having to go through any postnatal depression and look after a child, and they may have other children as well. So that's, I guess, where the pressure really builds up.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors that really emphasise someone's stress and then experience of distress as a result. I think housing's really important one. Not having family support or partner support can be really tough as well. Multiple other stresses in relationships happening. Instability can be quite a large factor as well.
Right. And a lot of those are prevalent in Northland. Housing particularly.
Yes, exactly.
So are you expecting a pretty challenging sort of an internship?
I think working with anyone that's having a hard time is always challenging, but really, really important. And I love the work. I think no matter where I go, I find it challenging always. And right. But I like that as well.
So part of the doctorate that you're doing is about a survey, isn't it? You're wanting to survey people that have used psychologists, and are there any other target audiences that you're working with in this survey?
No, it is purely people over 18 that have used the services of a clinical psychologist in New Zealand for mental health. It doesn't matter when people saw a psychologist or how many psychologists or what for. People just need to be able to draw on their experiences and then comment on some views.
Right. So how can people access the survey?
Yeah, so there's a Qualtrics link.
Qualtrics?
So it's an online survey, and it has been shared around quite a few different networks already. So I would suggest to keep an eye out for it. I've given you the link.
Yes, well, yeah, okay, but that may not help other people get access to it. Is there a simple way of explaining? I mean, I found this yesterday on my first day back at work on the BINZ website, B-I-N-Z.
Yes, it's also up on websites such as PeerZone. It's on the PeerZone Facebook page. It's on Drive Counties Manukau. Changing Minds will be advertising it. The Mental Health Foundation's putting out a bulletin on the 29th of January. And other networks like Fixate, ISPS, Hearing Voices Network. So if you haven't seen it already, hopefully you'll see it soon.
Right. So, but that will be all on Facebook, on Facebook pages, will it?
Or? It'll be Facebook, websites and mail outs as well. So if you have subscribed to one of the organisations, then it's likely they might let you know.
Right. So what are you calling the survey?
So it's a service user views of clinical psychologist competence survey. It's a bit of a mouthful.
Okay. So yourself, have you sought the support of psychologists?
Yes, I have. In different times of my life or different, experiences of distress. And the first time I saw a clinical psychologist, it changed my life. And I think that's probably been in the back of my mind for the rest of my life up till now, and informing, I guess, why I do what I do.
I mean, one of the issues with seeking help from a psychologist is how long that might be funded. I mean, I think that there are services now where you can go to your GP, certain DHBs, where they will give you 3 sessions or 6 sessions perhaps. Is that, I guess it depends on people's distress and the complexity of their issues that they are confronting the psychologist with. But is that long enough, do you think, 6 sessions, say, of an hour a time?
I think it depends. It really depends on the individual and their needs and also what they want and how helpful they think it is. Evidence suggests 6 is a good number.
Right.
But then people are so different, so it's really hard for me to answer that question, I think, in a simple way.
So this experience that you had, which it sounds as though it was very significant for you, what do you assess happened in that relationship with your psychologist?
I would just love to be able to go back and be a fly on the wall, because I think at that time I was so unwell that it's really hard to remember actually what went on in the room.
Right.
Part of my journey through this type of research is going back and talking to services that I've experienced before and getting notes off different people that I've seen. But because this one was so long ago, the notes weren't available anymore.
Right.
But what I do remember is just feeling really, really safe and not feeling judged, and I don't know, I think just sitting there with someone who I wasn't trying to be someone I was not, and it was okay to just be myself and just turn up how I was, you know, getting dragged out of bed and kind of forced to go.
Right.
But she made me feel really comfortable in that space, and it was really, really helpful.
So being honest with your psychologist is probably the first key priority, isn't it? It's not to cloud the issues or disguise really what's happening for you.
I guess so, but also I think I've learnt through my training that psychologists have a really important role in being able to facilitate that with someone in front of them, because when you have a client in front of you, they're in quite a disempowered space, and it's a lot to ask that they just come in with the stranger and kind of just put it all out on the line when they don't know what the consequences of that might be. So I think I really appreciated at that time my psychologist really allowing me to feel really comfortable and taking it at my pace.
Right.
So then I think the trust kind of grew from that.
I suppose taking it at the pace of the patient or the client is fine if it's being paid for by parents or somebody else. But if you're under a little bit of pressure, you feel you've only got 3 sessions or 6 sessions, then how do you manage it then? Do you've still got to go slowly for it to be meaningful.
I think that's a really hard one. And I think it is heartbreaking to me that people can't access services that they need, and that will be helpful. I think we know through research that the most important aspect is the relationship between the therapist and the client.
Yeah.
So I think if you're going to get one thing right, I think that is really, really important to remember.
So, I mean, one of the things that I've learned in the 12 years or so that I've been working in mental health, and I'd never considered it before coming into mental health, was that if the relationship is really good, then obviously there's no question about firing the psychologist. But if it doesn't feel comfortable, what's your suggestion that clients should do if it doesn't feel comfortable?
I think it's a really difficult position to be in. I think as a client, you can feel like you are judging your psychologist, and I know clients don't want to do that. But I think looking at how helpful it is for you and then perhaps feeding it back, and if you're not getting a satisfactory response, making sure that you try again to find a better fit for yourself. Right. I think that's really important, really difficult to do.
But providing a bit of feedback to the professional, to the psychologist, that perhaps what you're not completely comfortable with how the process is going.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, well, let's take a music break. Declan, you've been thinking about some tracks which might involve the themes of mental health.
I have. I've scurried about and found one here by Anna Nalick, or Nalick. Breathe, 2 a.m.
2 a.m. and she calls me cause I'm still awake. Can you help me unravel my latest mistake? I don't love him. Winter just wasn't my season. Yeah, we walk through the door so accusing. Their eyes like they have any right at all to criticize. Hypocrites, you're all here for the very same. Cause you can't jump the track. We're like cars on a cable, and life's like an hourglass glued to the table. No one can find the rewind button, girl. So cradle your head in your hands and breathe. Just breathe. Oh, I'm not afraid to die. used to. And I feel like I'm naked in front of the crowd, 'cause these words are my diary, screaming out loud. And I know that you'll use them however you want to. But you can't jump the track with like cars on a cable, and life's like an hourglass glued to the table.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And I'm host Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Curran, and we're talking today to university researcher Alice Stevenson, who is wanting a response to a survey that she is doing as part of her doctorate in clinical psychology. And so where are some of the places that people can respond to this survey? So there's a link that is being posted on a number of mental health Facebook pages, and other organisations are promoting it as well. So where can people look out for this link?
So at the moment it's being shared around Facebook, so it's on the Drive Counties Manukau page. That's a good one. The Consumer Tangata Whai Ora Network page has shared it. I know that's quite popular. Changing Minds will be putting something up shortly, and the Mental Health Foundation will be sharing it as well in their e-newsletter on the 29th of January. People can also email me directly and I can provide them with a link. Any queries will be absolutely confidential.
So are you happy to give out your mobile number if people were interested in talking to you?
If people are interested in talking to me, I suggest that first off they email me just so I can get a sense of what their query is, and then I can give them a call back if they provide a phone number.
Right, so your email is?
alice.stevenson.1@uni.massey.ac.nz.
Right, so we better get that out again later on in the show. You have done the Like Minds, Like Mine initiative, Rakau Raroa, which is something that has been developed by Changing Minds. You're one of their ambassadors. What took your fancy about that?
So I've been working with Changing Minds for about 2 years. When I started developing my idea for my study, I reached out to a lot of service user organisations in New Zealand and said, this is what I'm thinking of doing. Does anyone have any suggestions or ways I could improve my study or find out more? And Changing Minds provided amazing consultation straight away. They told me about the Rakau Raroa program, which I was really, really interested in and pretty excited about. And then the opportunity came up last year to do the training. And so I was so lucky to be offered it. And, of course, I jumped at the chance. Yeah. I just thought it was so important.
Right. Well, Rakau Raroa, I think, means tall trees. So so you're one of the campaign's tall trees.
Yeah, I guess so.
All right. And what's that involved? What have you been involved with consumers, clients, people that are experiencing mental health?
Well, I just took part in the training a couple of months ago, so just before the break. Over Christmas.
Right.
But the great thing about it is I have access now to a community of people kind of, I guess, like me, that I'm comfortable around, that have done the training too. And it's really cool to be able to say that I'm a rākaurauroa as well and identify myself in that way. I think I've been on the sidelines for quite a long time, training in clinical psychology. And so I think this has given me a way of kind of being and another identity as well,
right,
in a safe way. So that's really important. And I really hope that I can do some more work with that as I go along.
So back in the real world of people with lived experience rather than the sort of scholarly academic environment.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I guess, a way to kind of consolidate the two.
Right.
Because they don't necessarily have to be independent.
No. So it's great that you can integrate the reality and the academic as part of this doctorate. So if you're heading up north to do this internship in a couple of weeks, have you almost completed your doctorate?
Yes, yeah, so I'm 2 years through the 3-year program. So this will be my final year coming up.
So the survey is part of the doctorate, and will that complete once you've analysed the responses and all the research? That will complete your doctorate?
Yes, exactly. So we have in order to get a doctorate, we have to submit a doctoral thesis. So this research is a part of that, so it's a component of that. My data I'm collecting over the next 5 weeks, and then when that's done, I'll analyse and then write it up. Once I get that done, which will probably be this time next year, then I'll be finished, hopefully, if achieve everything to standard.
And we'll have you back on Take It From Us to talk about the results.
That would be amazing.
What sort of response have you had to asking people to talk about their psychologists?
So I've started advertising a week ago, and I've had quite a bit of response, a lot of interest. I'm so thankful to everyone that shared it around already. My fully completed responses for the survey are now in double digits. They're quite good, actually, for what I was expecting.
For completed responses?
Yes, so ones I can use to analyse. It has had a high dropout rate, which I expected, because the survey is quite detailed and it requires written responses, and sometimes it's really difficult to sit back and reflect over your own experiences and then comment in that way.
Right.
So I'm just so thankful to all the people that have stuck it out and pushed that submit button at the end.
Right.
Yeah, I've done it myself, and it's actually not easy. So.
Oh. Well, we don't want to put anybody off. How long do you anticipate it would take somebody who's showing interest?
So it takes from about 20 minutes to 40 minutes, but I have had people think about it for quite a long time and take a day.
Right.
Yeah, so it just depends on the person. But I think even though it can be challenging, it's really, really important that people complete it. I think that these voices we really, really need, where the profession's really, really hungry for more information from service users. So if you can contribute, it's just so valuable.
So is there a professional association of psychologists that have endorsed this survey?
So I've spoken to the professional bodies in psychology ever since I started the study and let them know what I was thinking about doing. The study's based on competencies that were written by the New Zealand Psychologists Board. And they're really happy with the study, and they're really interested to see what the findings will be.
Right.
So, yeah, I've been really well supported, and I've been supported by all clinicians in the field as well, professional and different professional bodies. So everyone's really excited about it and really, really eager to see what the findings will be.
Right. So there's no obvious sort of wealth of dissatisfaction that has encouraged you to do this?
No, and I think it's really important, because I think when I say that I'm collecting views about psychologists, I think straight away people think, oh, she wants to find out what's wrong or what's bad. But I guess I'm thinking more long term. So I'm thinking, what bits though were helpful or unhelpful, and what bits can we tease out? And from service users, what can we use to endorse in our training and how we govern the profession?
Mm-hmm.
Because we've had for a long time, about at least 30 years in New Zealand, we've had it recommended that mental health service users and whānau are asked their opinions. But actually, whether it's been tangibly implemented or not has been quite different in different mental health sectors. So I think psychology can really lead the way here and value the service user views.
Yeah, I mean, that term service user is a little bit ambiguous, isn't it? Because that is a term that is used for people that have got lived experience of mental health. Mm. But in your definition, a service user is just somebody who has used a psychologist or has not so much used a psychologist but has sought the support of a psychologist. But they may not necessarily fall into that category. I mean, I'm probably here being a little bit pedantic. I'm just interested in your observation about that.
I don't think you're being pedantic at all. I think wording's really, really important. I've done research like this before, and I have grappled with the terminology for years, and I get quite fixated on it. My supervision team know.
Right.
And I think the term service user can mean different things to different people. So personally, I think anyone with lived experience of mental distress could be a service user, but whether or not they've engaged in services is different. I think for the study, the criteria is that you need to have been face-to-face with a clinical psychologist.
Right.
And that's because I had to find a way to control my study to be able to report on it as a doctoral thesis in academia.
Right.
So that limits, I guess, who will take part, which is a shame, but I've had to contain it for now.
Right.
But I actually do think this work can be drawn upon in different sectors for different people with lived experience, because it's really important that the therapist you sit in front of, you view them as being competent at their job. So, yeah.
So really this is a measure of their competence?
Well, it's a measure of people's perceptions of their competence.
Right.
So it's not saying someone's good or bad or helpful or unhelpful, but it is really important that the person sitting opposite them that's vulnerable perceives them as helpful and competent.
Mm.
There has been a little bit of research that kind of backs that up.
I imagine that these psychologists could be in a number of different roles. They could be working in private practice. They could be connected with a community mental health centre. They might be part of a psychiatric unit even.
Absolutely. So a part of my survey, I ask respondents to say in what setting, just so I can describe the range of settings people have seen psychologists in. I think even though you could see a psychologist in all types of different settings and for different reasons as well, they all have to adhere to the same competencies and code of ethics. So yes, the professional regulation's the same. So I think regardless of what setting, it's still really, really important that we understand more about what makes a clinical psychologist seem really competent.
Right, right. Well, let's take another music break on Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, Declan.
I've got one here to do with insects. No, the Beatles. Let It Be. This one was remastered in 2009. It was Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio, broadcasting here every Tuesday from 12:30 to 1:30 on 104.6 Planet FM.
In times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be.
night is cloudy, there is still a light that shines on me. Shine until tomorrow, let it be. I wake up to the sound of music. Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom. Let it be.
And our stinger doesn't want to... Oh, oh, there you go, Beyonce. She's gone.
That's good. Well, on Facebook, and I'm host Sheldon Brown on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, I was attracted to a Facebook page which says, I'm not right in the head.com. And the first thing that popped up was a nice little saying which says, you don't realise how little self-control you have until you're eating chips and salsa at a Mexican restaurant. How would you be with chips and salsa, Alice?
Very good.
Very good? Mm-hmm. You would be able to resist or not resist?
Oh, I wouldn't be able to resist. No way.
Well, I... had a beer with a mate of mine who came up from Christchurch. We were sitting on Oney Tangy Beach, Charlie Farley's restaurant, and he ordered some chips, and I thought, well, they're not good for me. I'll be able to resist those. But a bit like the chips and salsa at a Mexican restaurant, I was right into them just as much as he was.
So. A word to the wise, if you're eating chips outside at a friend of mine in Sydney down by the Opera House and these blooming seagulls came down, knocked it out of his hands, and then swooped back for a feed.
Yeah, well, apparently on UK beaches, they're absolutely, they're like vultures.
Yeah, forget about the magpies.
Exactly. So today, anyway, we are talking to academic researcher Alice Stevenson about a survey which is going to complete her doctorate in clinical psychologist. Alice, just give us some of those Facebook pages again where the survey, so there'll be a link on these pages where people can just click on the link and go straight into the survey.
Yeah, there's a link. So some of them have been shared directly, so you can just click on it. Some have a picture of the advert, so you can copy and paste, and the link will still work. And it also has my email address on them too, so people can get in touch if they've got any questions or worries.
Right. So that's alice.stevenson1@uni.massey.ac.nz. Wow.
Well,
that's. I hope anybody that's interested has written this down. One of the things that you mentioned to me about mental health was the issue of labelling. What do you find good or bad about labelling?
I think that's a very open question. I think labelling can be useful in a way that people can reclaim their own identities or how they want to describe themselves. So I think that can be really useful. I think the issue with labelling is, as human beings, we do it all the time. It's kind of a way to shortcut, I guess, our thinking and to categorise people in certain ways. So I think there's issues with that in the mental health sector. There's a lot of stigma, which we know, and there's actually quite a lot of self-stigma and mental illness-related stigma as well. So I think it's really difficult to move away from labels because that's what we do as humans. But I do know my own experiences of labelling myself have perhaps not been so helpful. And
you mean self-labelling, so you're putting a label on yourself at a time when perhaps you're not as well as you'd like to be?
Yeah, exactly. Or other people putting a label on me and trying to understand me in the way they think that I might be which is might be different to how I actually am.
So what sort of label might they have chosen for you?
Well, I think it depends on the time. I think there's a lot of negative connotations that come when you're experiencing distress, such as drama queen, you know, some really derogatory comments I'm probably not going to repeat.
But it could be nutter or mad woman or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. And I think it moves away from actually understanding someone's distress. It becomes something that it's really not.
Adds to your distress.
Oh, exactly. Yes. Yeah. I think a massive part about disempowerment when people are experiencing distress is being labelled in a certain way and being seen in that way as well by society. Right. It's really has really big consequences.
The unfortunate thing is that some of the labels, particularly with the more severe end of mental health, like psychosis and schizophrenia, even bipolar, they're so emotive, they're so leading to people feeling that you could be dangerous or that you might catch the schizophrenia if you get close to them. What do you think needs to happen with those sorts of labels?
I think they need to be perhaps dealt with a bit differently in the media. I think sometimes labels feed into people's fears. You know, for example, the people with mental illness are dangerous, I guess, and I think it's really important to remember and be quite critical about the media you're consuming and realise that actually people with mental health presentations are more likely to be victims of crimes rather than perpetrators, right, and just being really aware. And I think once we start having more conversations like that and once people kind of feel comfortable and safe enough to come out and say, look, I've had these experiences, do you think I'm dangerous? Am I one of them? I think then we start kind of wrapping our heads around the diversity that there is. And even though we might have had similar experiences, we're quite a diverse group anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the benefits of a label, and I got my label of depression and anxiety when I was about 35. I guess I'd clearly had symptoms before that, but that's when it was sort of diagnosed and the doctor said to me, well, I think you've got depression. That was a shock to me, but it was also helpful that I could put a definition on it. I could research what depression was. I could hopefully adopt some strategies that were going to help. I was a bit slow probably in doing that, but I know how important those strategies are today. So that's a helpful part of labelling.
Yes, absolutely. I agree, and that's a really good point. I think As a psychology trainee, I agree with that too. And as a person, personally, I think it is really helpful to be aware and say, oh, hang on, what I'm feeling right now, oh, I know what this is okay.
Right.
This is part of my journey. So actually knowing what it is really helpful, and also being able to draw on the research and draw on what was helpful for other people with similar experiences is really helpful too.
Yeah.
So I agree.
I mean, I had a situation where I was in hospital probably 30 or 40 years ago, and a psychiatrist had decided that I was bipolar, but he never shared that with me, but he did share it with my wife. And when we broke up, I mean, I'm sure that she used it as a weapon against me. And I don't know that people know. I mean, Declan, you're quite open about your diagnosis. What sort of reaction have you had when you say or use the diagnosis bipolar?
I usually don't mention it to anybody initially, because if you're meeting someone for the first time and you bring that into the mix, It's like throwing a gremlin into the microwave.
Right.
It can cloud their judgment, and I think it's important that people get to meet you without a label and see you and discover your personality, and then down track, that doesn't have the same impact. The difficulty where it comes in is if you're applying for a job, do you disclose before you go into that job, or do you tell them after you've gotten it? So there's always that anxiety that comes with that as well. Yeah.
I mean, that whole issue of disclosure, Alice, is a major one, isn't it? When we have a mental health diagnosis or even just a vulnerability to mental health, what do we do about that? You know, what do we disclose it when we're applying for work?
I was just going to butt in here and quickly and say, not only is it how the employer would respond if you become unwell after you've started and haven't disclosed, how are my colleagues around me going to accept or reject me when they know?
Yeah.
And that can lead to bullying, all sorts of things. So it's a very, very fine line to walk.
Yeah.
And I think it's something individually that it depends on where you're working, who you're working with to make that decision.
Mm. But it does colour people's perception of you and thinking about you and that. Have you got any thoughts at all, Alice?
Absolutely. I agree with everything. I think it's context is really, really important, and I think your safety is really, really important. I've learned the hard way before about feeling pressured to share more than I was comfortable with, and over time I've realised that actually it's really important to keep myself safe and to not be pressured to overshare or not be pressured to undershare either.
Right.
So I think people taking the time to really reflect on their own safety and what they're comfortable with, I think is really, really important. And also remembering that everyone's journey is different. There might be people at different stages to you, and that's actually okay. I think it's a really, really personal thing, and it does have implications. And pretending that it will all be fine and stigma's gone, I think could put people in really unsafe positions potentially.
Well, I think stigma is alive and well in New Zealand, particularly in the more conservative arenas of New Zealand, and I don't know that we're going to rid the country of stigma, particularly among those less liberal, less aware sort of people and less empathetic people.
It's interesting you should add that, because in a particular organisation who will remain nameless, when I started I hadn't had the bipolar psychosis or the diagnosis, and when I had to ring up to extend the time I was off, it was coming up to Christmas, and his response, the manager's response was, is this a pre-existing medical condition you had prior to employment with the AA, because that would have been a good reason for him to just go boom and get rid of me. And I said, no, it wasn't. And he said, well, I can't afford to have staff off. This is a busy time of the year, et cetera, et cetera. So I felt like crap. Years down track after I'd left, because I only went back for about 3 weeks and couldn't handle it, I found out that he'd resigned on the 23rd of December a few years later, and I thought, what's good for the goose? And I basically got shunned by him after that. He'd walk past me, or I'd be sitting in the same room and he wouldn't even speak to me.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's take our third music break, Deacon.
You're going to love this one. I had this one selected this morning. Linda Ronstadt and Aaron Neville, All My Life. Beautiful song. Was taken from us, Mental Health Radio, on 104.6 Planet FM.
You somehow I'd see. And I asked for a little help from above.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And I'm host Sheldon Brown, and we're talking today to university researcher Alice Stevenson about her survey, which will complete her doctorate in clinical psychology. Just give us that email address again, Alice.
It's alice.stevenson.1. at uni.massey.ac.nz.
Wow, that's a...
I've written it down. Now, I just want to ask you, Stevenson, is that with a PH or a V?
Oh, with a V.
With a V. Okay, so we've got alice.stevenson.1 at uni.massey.ac.nz.
That's right.
Okay, I'll give that to Sheldon, so if anybody wants to either ring or text or email him, they will have that. I was getting bits as you went, and then I was coming back just to fill the blanks. And
thank you.
No worries.
And I've been quoting one or two little tidbits from Facebook, and one here says, even if you hear a bad story about me, understand there was a time I was good to those people too, but they won't tell you that part. So people, Alice, people are a bit selective about what they say about us, particularly if they've fallen out with us, perhaps.
Yeah. Yes.
I found personally that the good thing that came out of it when everything hit the fan was you really found out who your true friends were the ones that stayed and supported you and the ones that were just there for the good times. You know, I always say friends, the whole big crux of friendship is who the heck is there when right. Everything goes boobs up.
Well, when it goes mental health bad, it's unlikely that people will probably visit you. But I had a bit of surgery a couple of years ago, and I mean, I was amazed at the support and the outpouring and the flowers, and which I had never experienced when I sort of disappeared out of life to end up probably in an acute ward somewhere. So I think there is a bit of discrimination in terms of where support comes from, and it depends a lot on what your health experience is. Yeah. Is there some psychology related there, Alice?
Yeah, it's definitely been shown in the research and the literature for sure that if you have a physical issue or something that people can see, it's more supported than a mental issue. I think perhaps because people are more wary about things they can't see right. maybe.
Yeah.
Or we'll have different connotations about that too. So that might be a social thing as well, with the stigma and discrimination entering into that too. So it kind of filters the lens we see things through, and it can be a bit scary if we don't know it or are as familiar with it.
Right. I think the media too, when something happens to someone, if there's a mental illness connection, that's sort of highlighted in that particular event, which disappoints me. And it's like the same thing with where we've got suicide figures that are twice what the road toll is, and yet every night we see a major road crash presented, you know.
Or a lot more money spent on road safety exactly. than on the safety of our lives in New Zealand. I'd just like to ask, just in the last few moments that we have, Alice, clearly you have a wellness strategy.
Yes, I have many wellness strategies.
Oh, do you?
That I'll kind of pick and choose depending on what's going on.
Right.
So I think first up is making sure when I'm feeling good that all my things are kind of lined up. So really good sleep, which I actually forget, which sounds silly, but yeah. So I make sure I'm sleeping well, eating well, try to get outside and connect with nature every day. It's really important to take the time for me to do that. And sometimes I feel like I'm too busy or I shouldn't, but actually it's really key for me. I think recognising when I'm becoming distressed as well is really important, and recognising my triggers and making sure I can move away from them to keep myself safe. And also I think, like what we were saying before, is making sure people around me are really appropriate and supportive and not judgmental. That's really key as well, when maintaining appropriate boundaries with people that might not be so supportive or helpful.
So you have to be selective, a little bit selective about your friendships, or you just have to make sure that there are boundaries with certain people and you make sure they don't go over that boundary.
Yeah, I think honouring your boundaries is really important, and not feeling guilty when you do that.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm learning, and I'm a lot older than you, but like I play a lot of tennis, and I guess I'm learning that maybe the tennis club is just a place where you socialise and you don't have too many serious conversations, and it's just a sort of a, you know, veg out and play your game, have a drink with people and go home, instead of trying to address those issues which seem to me to be very important and world significant, really.
Yeah, exactly. I find that quite a lot. Sometimes I'll be in a setting and I'll start going on about something really important to me, and then and kind of think, oh, maybe I'll pick my audience actually on this one.
Right. Well, thank you, Alice. We only made contact yesterday, and I very much appreciate your response to Take It From Us and doing the interview.
Thank you.
And I just want to throw a couple of contact numbers in here if anybody has their computer and wants some support lines: mentalhealth.org.nz, Lifeline 0800 543 354, and go and have a look on the Sparks, sparx.org.nz. We're out of here.
Good night.
See you next week.
Thanks, Bethan.